On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Americans love the coast. Millions live there right on it. But a big new report says this century is going to be tough for coastal living, that global warming and rising seas are already changing the forecast, that floods we think of as once-a-century monsters will come once a decade, and the whole country is likely to pay. This hour on Point, rising seas and the outlook for coastal America. You can join the conversation. Is that you, perched on the coast? Do you believe the warnings, the cause? And if this is the new reality, how should we handle it? We're at 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, and you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We've all seen plenty of storms. Irene was huge last summer. Here's Jeff Petrosky from Weather Nation on the Outer Banks of North Carolina, Cape Hatteras, in the middle of that storm.
The water's coming in to Hatteras, west of here. The water's breached the dunes, and it's cut it in two. The island's now getting water across it, and it's cutting it off. We may have a new inlet again. We'll see how bad it is on the west side. We haven't been able to go out there the last hour. But there may be a new inlet being cut west of me about 3 miles.
Those storms can come in hard on the coast. Here's more from Hurricane Irene. This was NBC Storm Chasers Mike Tyson, Jim Reed, right on the coast of Gulfport, Mississippi, taking refuge here from the floods on top of their hotel.
We're four stories up, and you can see the water. The surge is dramatically risen here. This is Mother Nature at her worst right here.
Mother Nature at her worst. The new report says, well, maybe you haven't seen anything yet. In this hour, we will go right to the coastline in Sarasota, Florida, for an on-the-water look from a longtime local watching the sea. And we will look at how big insurance and the federal government are responding to the rising threat. But first, with me from New York is Ben Strauss, climate scientist, chief operating officer of Climate Central, and director of their program on sea level rise. He's co-author of the big new report out last week from Climate Central titled Surging Seas, Sea Level Rise, Storms, and Global Warming's Threat to the U.S. Coast. Ben Strauss, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Now, we heard your report last week. A lot of people were talking about it, but it's not the first time. I mean, people have been watching the coast and projecting what's going to happen for a long time. What's new in what you've found, Ben?
Sure. Well, the first thing, and what really surprised us, is we found that sea level rise from global warming has already doubled the risk of extreme coastal flooding across the United States. Something else that we did that was new is we evaluated the risk for 3,000 coastal towns, cities, and states, and created a tool that is really easy for anyone to use at surgingseas.org. So we made it accessible for people who aren't necessarily scientists, and we made it local.
And by the way, I should say you can link to that at our website, onpointradio.org. It's pretty interesting. Put in your zip code if you're near the shore, and you can see what Ben Strauss and his crew think is coming for you in this century when it comes to rising seas. What did you find, Ben? What do you see coming?
Well, we found that about 5 million Americans live less than 4 feet above their local high tide line. We also did an analysis over time of the risk of flooding to that level, and we found that at most sites, when you combine, at most locations that we looked at across the United States, when you combine the effect of sea level rise together with regular patterns of storm surge and tides, that the majority of those sites are likely to see water levels up to that 4-foot line by 2030.
So you're not predicting a 4-foot rise in sea level, but you're predicting that even if you're anywhere within 4 feet, you may be hit because of a combination of what? Global warming caused sea rising and weather patterns, surge patterns.
That's right. Basically, sea level rise is a little bit, I'd say that the situation is a little bit like raising the floor of a basketball court. You're going to see a lot more dunks. And raising the floor is the sea level rise part. The dunk is a coastal storm surge.
So we're talking about, you say, 5 million people within that. How likely is that level of sea level rise that would put people within even 4 feet of high tide at risk?
Well, I think
more than at risk, underwater, I guess you're saying.
Sure. Strictly speaking, our analysis looked at what would be below the elevation of the waterline. So some places will have protections. For example, a lot of New Orleans is already below the high tide line, but it's protected by high levees. Therefore, we're not making predictions about each spot. But if you are below the waterline, you have a lot to be concerned about. First of all, you may be directly flooded. Second of all, if your defenses are breached, like we saw with Katrina in New Orleans, there's no easy way for the water to get out. And finally, if there's a lot of rain happening at the same time you have a coastal surge, which is quite common, it's very hard for that fresh water, that rainwater, to drain off the land and into the ocean like it normally would if the sea is higher. So there really are flood risks coming in from every direction here.
You're talking 5 million people who could be affected by that. That is a lot of people, and presumably around them a lot of property. What about the property value? It's kind of mind-boggling to think how much American property sits within that band of vulnerability.
It absolutely is. A lot of valuable beachfront property. We didn't do an economic analysis, but I will tell you that a study is coming out in Florida that looked at property values in just three South Florida counties, Monroe County, Broward County, and Palm Beach, not including Miami-Dade, which has the most low-lying coastal property. But in those three counties, they found $30 billion of appraised real estate less than 3 feet above the high tide line.
So you're talking a lot. And looking here at the biggest populations vulnerable to this, New Orleans, as you say, and we've already seen how that works, New York City, right there, looking at top cities, Hialeah, Florida, and then right on down, a little more Los Angeles, Louisiana, but mainly Florida here, real big vulnerability. Now, what sort of absolute sea level rise is underlying these predictions? I mean, what kind of sea level rise have we actually seen already over time, and what's the finding or the presumption in your study, Ben, that underlies these predictions?
Yes. So what we've already seen over the last century plus is about 8 inches. It may not sound like a lot, but one vertical foot in some places can translate to one horizontal mile. What scientists are projecting for the next century globally is between 2 and 7 more feet. So that's a very steep acceleration. I'd say most of the leaders in the field would put their money on something between 3 and 4 feet for this century. And when you combine that with the storms we regularly see, that's an awful lot. In our research, we made localized projections at 55 locations around the United States where we had really excellent historical records, and we could break out a local component caused by rising or sinking land, which is another issue around the United States, and combine that with these global projections to get a localized scenario for each place, which you can also see on our map online.
So a 2 to 7 foot sea level rise, it's a big range, but if it's somewhere mid-low on that, we've got a lot of vulnerability. You looked at 55 locations. Take us on a kind of national tour around the coast, if you'd be good enough, Ben. Who's vulnerable in what way and how vulnerable?
Sure. We found, let's see, the least vulnerable place that we found was the northwest tip of the Olympic Peninsula, where the land is actually rising.
Okay.
So we estimate...
This is Washington State. We're way out on the northwest coast.
Washington State, at the Strait of Juan de Fuca.
Okay.
So it's different at Seattle, actually. Seattle is not rising so much. But at the very tip, we project just another 1 inch of sea level rise by 2030 and maybe 4 inches or so by 2050.
So the Strait of Juan de Fuca as the coastal refuge here. Okay.
Yes.
Take us on.
A lot of places in the Gulf of Mexico are the land is sinking rapidly. The same is true in the Chesapeake region. And that's due to a variety of factors. The retreat of the great ice sheets after the last ice age, actually pumping oil, gas, and water, mining those things from under the ground, reduces pressure and leads to sinking, and also compaction of sediment. So for those places, we're projecting up to 8 or so inches by 2030 and up to a foot and a half by 2050.
Oh, you're talking sinking there. I was thinking of the overall impact. I mean, the place that you really describe as vulnerable is Florida. I don't know about the sinking part, but what struck me was the porous sort of foundation that Florida sits on made you say that, as I read your report, the combination of rising seas, everything else you described, plus that porous stone underneath, the water can come in. Even if you build a dike, the water comes just from underneath.
Yes, no, that's absolutely right. I was just going on how many inches by what year there. But when we look at the assets in different places and also the defensibility, Florida stands out. Of the 5 million people who live within 4 feet of the high tide line today, half of them are in Florida. And furthermore, South Florida has this problem that they indeed are sitting on a Swiss cheese porous bedrock, and you really can't build a seawall to protect yourself there unless you're willing to dig a trench 100 feet deep, I'm told. And that is surely going to be prohibitively expensive.
We've got a lot of challenges described in this new report, and we're going to dig into them in this hour. Plus, we're going to look go down to Florida, talk with get a firsthand view from Sarasota, and look at the insurance implications of this and just the cost of this and who's going to end up paying for it. It doesn't look, from what we're seeing here, like it's all going to be people on the coast. To the extent the government steps in, those costs get spread right across the country. Ben Strauss, please stand by in New York with Climate Central. The new report is Surging Seas. And listeners, you can join us. Is this you in the path of rising seas? What's your plan? Build a dike? Build on stilts? Get the heck out? Do you buy the whole picture being painted here, that we're looking at a great age of coastal flooding and destruction from rising seas? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the watery outlook for coastal America in a century of rising seas, a new warning of flood and destruction in a time of global warming. Ben Strauss is with us. He's co-author of the big new report out from Climate Central, saying that once a century storms may become once a decade storms, maybe worse. And that's going to mean a lot of, you name it, for millions of people along the American coast. You can join the conversation this hour. Will global warming wash out the American oceanfront? And how should we respond here? Should we keep underwriting insurance for coastal dwellers? Can we afford to? How do we live with these new realities? Is this the reality that we face? Do you buy it? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Ben, the report makes a lot of these rare storms or rare storm impacts becoming much more common. The once a century flooding becoming, how common are you saying, and by when?
Well, the place that is most under the gun there is Southern California. And we
talking
see
Los Angeles, San Diego, where?
Yes, Los Angeles and San Diego.
Okay.
And the stretch between them. And we see today's once a century flood becoming an annual, more frequent than annual event by the middle of the century.
More frequent than annual. I mean, by the time you deal with the aftermath, that's basically you're living all the time with the. What does that mean?
Yes. Well, what it means in Southern California, they actually don't see a lot of large storms. The century flood today is almost the same as a once in 10-year flood. So basically, no one ever sees water much above 3 feet over the high tide line. And by 2050, you'll be seeing water up to 4 feet above the high tide line regularly. So there's a whole strip of land there which has no experience of coastal flooding and is going to be wet all the time.
What would that look like in Los Angeles? When we think of the hills, are they going to be islands once this water comes in?
Well, it is pretty hilly, fortunately, and that will protect a lot of the area. But there are some pretty flat, low-lying places that are important, like Huntington Beach. Long Beach is, I believe, the nation's largest port, and there's vulnerable area there. Newport Beach, Malibu, there are quite a few areas that have exposed land.
And what's the level of certainty that you're bringing to this? You know that a lot of people arch their eyebrows when it comes to these kind of predictions and say, oh, I just don't buy it. What's the foundation that this is sitting on?
Yeah. It's sitting on a few foundations. The first is, very simply, we've already watched the sea level rise 8 inches over the last century. So that's
very
clear.
But 8 inches is not 2 feet and certainly not 7 feet.
That's true. So the other thing we have is the long-term historical record over the many tens of thousands and millions of years. And in that record, there is a very clear relationship between global temperature and global sea level. Sea level historically has gone up and down by 300 or 400 feet between ice ages and the warm periods between them. Past performance is not a guarantee of future performance, as we know from mutual fund ads, but it's our best indicator. And the last time we had a warm period between ice ages, it got a couple degrees warmer than it is right now, but we're headed there almost certainly this century from the warming that we're doing that's underway. And when it was just a couple degrees warmer than it is now, sea level was almost certainly between 20 and 30 feet higher.
Wow.
So I think that is our very, very likely long-term equilibrium. We are redrawing the map. The question is, how fast and just how far?
Ben Strauss, please stand by there. In just a moment, we'll go to Sarasota, Florida, see what we can learn there. Let's hear from our listeners. They've got a lot of experience right on the coast all over the country. Sandy in Glastonbury, Connecticut. Thanks for calling, Sandy. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom, for taking my call. Mm-hmm. My family has a cottage right on Long Island Sound off of Branford, Connecticut.
Okay.
And the storm Irene really took a toll on most of our area. The storm came right at high tide. But what we've noticed is Long Island Sound, being basically a closed environment, has suffered greatly because we've created so many seawalls and whatnot that the sea has no place to go when it rises except up. It can't go into the salt marshes anymore. We've prevented it from doing that by building seawalls and houses on the coast and so forth.
Sandy, if I may, what's your family conversation there about the cottage there on the coast? Are you thinking, well, we've got it for another 10 years or 20 or 30? Are you thinking eventually it's going to be, it sounds terrible, but washed away? Or how do you talk about it among yourselves?
Well, it's a real possibility. We saw two or three of our neighbors literally have the waves come up and take out their entire bottom floor during Storm Irene. We were protected on the other side, but we saw the natural high tides we have, the seasonal high tides, even this year, are 6 inches higher than they were 5 years ago. And that's just a regular high tide, let alone the storm surge high tide. So we're really looking at, we've created a lot of what we're dealing with by building these seawalls, as I said, along the coast.
Yeah, Sandy, we've got it one way and another, human intervention there. Good luck to your family. Let me move on down the coast. James Island. Thank you, Sandy. James Island, South Carolina. David's calling. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I just want to say, I've been a surfer my whole life, and I've been watching these storms. Even when they don't hit, when they're just off the coast, which they've been a lot of the last few years for us, the devastation is still huge. I mean, the amount of erosion, just the beach on Folly Island is basically gone. It's wiped out the county park. That's what Irene did. I mean, the waves are great. They're huge. But I'll tell you, even when they don't hit us, those storm surges and those wave sizes have come in and just washed the beaches away. And, for me, I'm 18 feet above sea level, so I'm on a high part of the island. But even then, you worry.
And as a surfer who knows the ocean intimately, you feel like you can actually see it in the water in its reach. I mean, you've been out on them as the storms come in.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've got some great photos from us surfing during Irene. And, some of those waves were triple overhead. And until that time, I'd never seen a wave that big at Folly. I mean, they were huge and great time. But, they had a lot of power, a huge rip in the water, just a lot of ferocity. And, this storm was several miles off our coast. So I just can't imagine if one of these things were to directly hit Charleston. I mean, it would sink our city.
There's the word right from the water. Thank you, David. And let me get to Sheila in Marion, Massachusetts. Sheila, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have done coastal research on community response to sea level rise, and the study that I looked at was actually looking at island abandonment in the Chesapeake Bay region. about 100 years ago. And the, one of the things that I found in my research is that the community response was usually done on an individual basis. So people moved as they had the resources available to them to move. But ultimately, the abandonment came because of community collapse, where people kept leaving, so there wasn't enough people to support the school or the church or the post office. And once those community services left, the people then followed, even though the coastal area was still habitable. And so one of the things I found in my study is that the most vulnerable to sea level rise are going to be those that don't have resources available to them to move, to sell their homes or move farther inland.
And interestingly, Sheila, you're saying that it wasn't a coordinated response. It was just kind of household by household dealing with these giant effects.
Correct. Yeah, people had, you know, more or less tolerance for the storm event. Some people moved rather quickly. Others tried to shore up their property. But eventually, they all had to leave. And this is on Holland Island in Maryland. And there were dozens of islands, actually, in Maryland that were abandoned about 100 years ago. So this has been going on for a century now, and is probably only going to get worse in coastal areas. And again, the poor are the most vulnerable to this.
Sheila, I really appreciate that. I'd like to dig into just into that angle of this one day. I appreciate your call. Let's stay in touch. And one more here. Bill in Ipswich, Massachusetts. Bill, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Yeah, I'd just like to tell you, I don't know if you've been covering this, but there's actually five camps that are being removed today off of Barrier Beach in Chatham.
On Cape Cod.
Sorry?
On Cape Cod. And these by camps, what do you mean exactly, Bill?
These are beach camps.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the Cape Cod National Seashore that is removing them.
Why are they removing them? Why?
Sorry?
Why are they removing them?
Because of sea level rise. This island has been eroding at the rate of about 100 feet a year since a new inlet opened up in 2007.
Mm-hmm.
And the point that I would like to make is that although sea level rise is a long-term process, you can make decisions about it in the short term. What we actually did down in Chatham is we had some cameras that were pointed out at the houses, and I would make daily erosion reports.
So what, you're telling residents there you've got X number of days before you're tumbling?
Exactly. You could tell them, you know, starting 2 weeks out, you could tell them they had between 8 and 10 days, and then 5 and 6 days, and then 2 and 3 days before their house would be washed away. And then that would give them the ability to either move their houses out of harm's way or have them demolished. And actually, they could get reimbursed if they demolished the houses themselves. They'd get reimbursed by the Federal Flood Insurance Program.
So that's already going on. I mean, Bill, we've got it, and I've got to ship down to Florida for a second here, but what an idea if this is magnified around the country, people all over the country getting, as you say, 2 weeks or a week or within 3 or 4 days' notice, your house is going. We see you're right in the middle of it there, Bill, and I appreciate your call. I want to go to Sarasota, Florida. David Patton joins us there. He's owner of Two Green Thumbs Landscaping, been a Sarasota coastal resident since 1958, and he watches what's going on very firsthand. David Patton, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm good. Do you see the kind of...
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, you're way ahead of me. You see it. What's happening?
I live on a chain of barrier islands off the coast of Florida. I'm off of Sarasota.
Yep.
Down south of the mouth of Tampa Bay, there's a string of seven islands, and we're sitting on a quartz crystal 99%. This is the number one beach in America. I don't know if everybody's heard about it.
It's gorgeous.
A public beach.
Yeah.
But as we were talking earlier, I'm listening about porous. I mean, we're sitting on a sand base. I own two houses on this island, and they just had the house surveyed across the street from me, and I thought I was a little higher than that, but the mark in front of the house on my back bum in the canal system in the middle of the island, it says 4 feet 5 inches.
Do you see beach loss already, David?
Oh, totally. I mean, we have gone, and they're doing a thing on Longboat Key right now. They put $4.5 million worth of sand, which they pumped in off of 10 miles offshore, and in a year, it's gone.
You watch it in an intimate way.
Storm, Tom. We're not talking storms.
Right.
We're talking regular high. The you know, the 60s, the new 40. Well, yeah. low tide, new high tide.
Do you got intimate kind of interaction every day with this land and these waters? Do you see more coming? Do you believe these dire predictions?
No question about it. No question about it. I don't know what my kids are going to do with this house.
Oh, how do you think Florida is going to handle it? I mean, you know how much development is there and how much people love it. What's going to happen?
Okay, the house I live in was built in 1962. It's mm-hmm. on ground level, okay? Mm-hmm. Now there's two of the houses in my neighborhood. I live in a neighborhood on the mouth of Big Pass. Google it, Earth. You can see that between Siesta Key and Lido Key, that's called Big Pass. There's two new houses that got built down there. The one in 2005, the first floor was, they pounded pilings for weeks, and then the first floor was 18 feet above sea level.
Okay.
Okay, they just built a house next door to it.
Mm-hmm.
That house, the first floor has to be 22 feet above mean high tide.
It'd be a skyscraper just to get to the, just to get to the house.
If you don't have an elevator, you better be in good shape.
What's the conversation you're hearing among Floridians then? You're there on the West Coast, on the Gulf Coast. I mean, how do people take this on board? If they buy it, what do they do with it?
This is a resort community, and not everybody lives here full-time like I do, but a bunch of my neighbors do, and I talk to different people, and we have not seen, the highest tide I've ever seen on this island was in 1962 Hurricane Donna. But like I said, I watch sunset as often as I can. I go down to the beach. I live a quarter of a mile.
We're jealous. Okay.
Okay, sorry. But as I'm watching this, and you're no longer allowed to put seawalls or rocks on the beach. There's a road called Beach Road, which now dead ends on the north end, and it's completely blocked off, and the people used to come in and park their cars on that. They can't get in to their homes anymore. This road is completely eroded away.
So is everybody going to lift their house to 22 feet off the ground, or are they going to move out, or just hang in, build a dike, what?
The older homes are going to be, at some point, probably demolished, and they built two new bridges to the island, and they're both pretty high. You can get a boat under them very easily. But I see the tide on a regular basis higher than, I mean, like I said, I've been here for 50 years, and it's a whole lot higher than it used to be.
David, stand by. And Ben Strauss, Dan is calling from Georgetown, Massachusetts. Dan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
My point is I think the media here, the people that are supposed to be informing us, freedom-loving Americans, they're not even coming close to reporting how big of an issue this is. I'll give you a for instance.
Okay.
In Boston here, over the last week, we've set records, I think, 3 out of the 7 days.
You're talking warm weather records. Yes, it's been like summer.
Yesterday, for instance, at Logan Airport, they reported a temperature of 72 degrees, which beat the old record of 70 degrees. But that's completely inaccurate. At my house, which is 25 miles north of there, I had in my house 78.5 degrees. In Concord, New Hampshire, which is another 30 miles north of me, they had 82 degrees.
So let me ask you, Dan, we've got that. When Ben Strauss says global warming is real and the oceans are rising and it's going to really take a bite into our coast, you're believing it, I guess.
Well, regardless of the sea level rise, the temperature itself, they're not even, they said that we had a high of 72. I know people in Boston, they were seeing a temperature of 80 degrees.
Dan, I appreciate your call. I mean, anybody who was here certainly knew that it was a darn warm day. Ben Strauss, do you think, I mean, here you're putting out your report, and it's got a lot of attention, but that's a moment in a, you know, in a long media life. Do you think that Americans are being adequately informed about what is likely headed their way?
No, I don't. I agree with the caller. We need a lot more information. It's a challenging topic, I think, for the media to cover because it's enormous, but it's slow at the same time. I mean, it's a speeding bullet in terms of how much, how fast things have changed historically in geological time. But in the news cycle, it feels slow.
Ben Strauss,
so we're missing a lot of info.
Stand by there in New York if you'd be good enough. And David Patton in Sarasota, Florida. When we come back, Charlene Lurig joins us to look at the insurance implications of this. And you can join the conversation. What do you think? Will global warming wash out the American ocean front? A big piece of it. How should we respond? Is this the reality we're facing? 800-423-8255 is our number. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And we're talking this hour about the watery outlook for coastal America in a century of rising seas, a new warning of flood and destruction in a time of global warming. Ben Strauss is with us. He's co-author of the new report from Climate Central, Surging Seas, it's called. And you can hear what he's describing here. Once a century, storms in some parts of this country become as much as becoming as frequent as annual. That's kind of hard to get your head around. We've got an interactive map where you can punch in your zip code or zip code of a location that you like to visit and see what they're predicting for the years ahead. He joins us today from New York. David Patton is with us. He's a landscaper in Sarasota, Florida, sort of unofficial mayor of his neighborhood down there. Been a coastal resident in Sarasota since 1958, and you hear what he's describing in terms of the ocean and land and where they meet right in his backyard. With us right now from Austin, Texas, is Charlene Lurig. She's senior manager of the insurance program at Ceres. It's a nonprofit organization, works with companies and investors to address sustainability and climate change. We're going to ask her about the insurance prospects here. And you can join us this hour, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. What's your observation here? What's your question on where we're headed? Charlene, in Austin, Texas, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Who's going to pay for all this? And what does it mean for insurance?
Well, in the end, most of the people who are going to be paying for this are going to be taxpayers. And the reason is that in the U.S., unlike most places in the developed world, we mostly back up flood insurance through federal tax dollars, through something called the National Flood Insurance Program, which has been in place since 1968. That program today is about $18 billion in debt. The reason being that the NFIP takes in about 40% of what it would actually need to take in for premiums if it were really going to price the risk that it's putting onto its balance sheets. The flood program usually takes in just as much money as it would need to pay out in an average year. So typically, flood losses in the United States might be something on the order of $600 million. The problem is that those average years are punctuated by truly catastrophic years, years like 2005 when Katrina hit, when the flood insurance program saw $17 billion in flood claims in a single year. So that's just fundamentally a pricing problem that the program has never adapted to.
So you're saying that private insurance is what? They've just pretty much backed away from the coast? What role does private insurance play at this point along the coast?
Private insurers still underwrite wind risk. So any sort of damage caused by a hurricane or a tropical storm that's caused by wind would still be provided by private carriers. Now, that even is changing in many areas. In Florida, the largest insurance company providing wind coverage is actually the state of Florida through something called Citizens Insurance. There are a number of other states that may be headed in that direction as well because there's plenty of political pressure to keep insurance rates low. That's partly why the National Flood Insurance Program continues to undercharge based on its risk.
So what do you imagine coming? If Ben Strauss and his crew are correct in their projections, and we're going to see once a century storms become once a decade around the country or in some places once a year, what happens when the costs of grappling with all this destruction grow, you know, along that kind of rhythm? Who steps in, or is there a point at which the system just breaks here and people can't rebuild and the population changes?
Well, the system is already pretty much broken. It's just kind of creaking along year by year. There are bills currently pending in both the House and the Senate that would reform the National Flood Insurance Program to slowly phase in risk-based rates and start to take some of those properties, those repeat loss properties that constitute about 1% of the program but actually make up about 30% of the claims, take those out of commission after the next loss. It's not really clear where those bills are going to go. But most likely what will happen if we don't actually adjust to planning proactively for the changes that we should anticipate in our cities and our communities is the unplanned retreat that one of your callers earlier spoke to, which has happened before, where people just decide they can't come back financially or emotionally, and those communities slowly decay.
David Patton, you're there in Sarasota, Florida. You know a lot of people. You watch what they do. Storms come in. They do their damage. What do you see in terms of how people respond and their expectations? Is it still people's expectation that they're insured enough to stay there, that they'll rebuild come what may, David?
Tom, I don't think we've been informed properly. And I was just listening to the last caller. I have citizens for my flood insurance, and they still will insure my house for flood. It's very expensive. And then I had the Bankers Life, but most of the insurance companies have pulled out of Florida. You can get wind, you can get fire, but you cannot get flood insurance, which means here comes the Gulf.
But then there's the National Flood Insurance Program. So does that mean the federal government stands behind people at that point?
I don't think anybody should have to cover my ground. So we need to rehabilitate that big time. It's costing everybody for us that want to live on the coast, and I think it's affecting our country.
You know, Charlene, there's a danger when you've got the federal government standing behind things that you just kind of live in a daydream here, because you imagine that no matter what the cost, it'll be covered. But what Ben Strauss's outfit is describing here is on such a scale that surely even for the federal government, there's a limit.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, you're absolutely right. The flood program also is in the very precarious position of not having updated its flood maps in a very long time. Now, they're slowly starting to change that. But the problem is it's not so much a technical challenge to understanding what our present-day flood risk exposure is. It's a political challenge. So FEMA, which administers the flood program, can actually redraw the maps. But being able to set pricing based on those maps and being able to change the way that communities build based on those maps is a totally different process. You know, the thing that's really valuable about the tool that's being developed by Climate Central, the Surging Seas tool, is that it actually democratizes this information. If the flood program maps are not even updated to present-day risk standards, how are individuals who are buying homes or businesses – how are large investors supposed to understand what sort of risk they are taking on?
Charlene, of course, the U.S. is not alone in this threat if we've got the global warming, sea rise, and the rest. And now I thought I heard you say that the U.S. may be unusual in having the government back these oceanfront or near-the-coast properties with, in effect, government insurance. What do insurance companies do in other countries? What's happening to premiums or to coverage there? Are people just going naked, or are they raising premiums through the roof, or what do you know?
Well, if you look at Europe, say the United Kingdom, where flood risk is actually taking a very heavy toll on local communities there, the private insurance market is still very robust. So that risk is being held by private insurers. And they've been, as a result, very engaged, working with local governments there, like the City of London and others, around the sort of infrastructure investments that need to be put in place to defend those communities in order to continue to insure them over time. That dynamic does not exist in the United States, not only because the private insurance market isn't exposed to flood, but because we seem not to have developed the political will to actually start to require any sort of entity that is receiving federal dollars, whether it's through federal grants or federal loans, to plan for sea level rise. So no airport, no roads, no electric substations, no water treatment plants, no nuclear power plants being built on the coast that are receiving federal dollars are required to plan for sea level rise.
Boy, that's just unbelievable. It means we're not getting market signals about what may be coming, and we're not factoring in the cost that, again, Ben's crew says are bearing down on us here. I mean, we're talking about, if you got up to 4 feet, a huge amount of land that would be hit. I think the study says 3 million acres, roads, bridges, commercial buildings, military bases, agricultural land, toxic waste dumps, presumably that would be unloosed by the schools, hospitals. Let me get a call right here, if I may, from an important coastal area, Norfolk, Virginia. Skip is calling. Skip, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on. I was on about a year ago when you did a story on Norfolk and sea level rise.
Oh, yeah. Is this Skip Stiles? Is that we talked with you way back then. How's it going?
Yeah. Well, it's going well. We're still plugging away. But I got to say that little has changed along the shoreline. I mean, we intervene directly in development decisions, trying to keep people from developing some of the low-lying land that Climate Central study pointed out. And we get no help from the federal government, as the previous speaker said. We're seeing insurance signals. We're seeing withdrawal of insurance. But if you want to put a subdivision on a low-lying piece of land, VA and HUD will still insure the mortgages. FEMA will still provide the flood insurance and the post-hazard mitigation. The Economic Development Administration will still provide the county money regardless of elevation. Even EPA will approve sewer plants, as was mentioned, in their revolving loan program. The only federal agency that's acted is the Corps of Engineers, which now has a policy of including sea level rise in its buildings. But, you know, when we go before a county board of supervisors trying to block a development decision, and they look at me and then they look around and go, well, I don't see anybody saying this is a bad idea. Nobody from the federal government is, in fact, they're giving me the money I need, so we're going to go ahead and approve it.
How do you interpret this, Skip? Is this denial? Is it disbelief? They just don't believe that we're going to be facing the kind of problems that Climate Central is describing here? Or they what?
Most of the people who live in these areas get wet, and they're getting wetter, and they know it, and they know there's a problem. But the issue really is, for a lot of these localities, the property tax revenue that's being promised by these developments, unless they do life cycle costing and unless the federal government is sending market signals that clearly say, we're not going to insure this development along your shoreline, they go ahead and encumber the future taxpayers with the cost of cleaning up this mess that we're building along the shoreline. I mean, you know, today.
And merrily we go on our way. Skip Stiles with Wetlands Watch there in Norfolk, Virginia. It's good to hear from you again, Skip. I appreciate your call. That's a real heads up. One more right here. Margarita, Providence, Rhode Island. Margarita, you're on the air.
Hi. This is a great call. I totally agree with your previous speakers. I actually work in environmental programs in the coastal and ocean programs, and two things I want to point out. One, there is a program called Climate Ready Estuaries that's run by EPA that has been actually trying to do some of these vulnerability assessments that the previous caller just spoke about, you know, this disconnect between where we place our infrastructure and what's going to happen. So that might be something people might be interested in.
Yep.
But my larger point was, there are many communities that I'm familiar with, particularly in the Chesapeake area, where, for example, the coastal zone programs have been trying to get people to start planning for this sort of eventuality. And in fact, those communities are extremely resistant, for whatever political or other reasons, to accepting any kind of planning for sea level rise. And so my point would be, well, if they want to prevent any kind of planning or take any responsibility for what's going to happen, then we should, at the same time, say, fine, it's on your dime. We should stop subsidizing that kind of deniable activity.
Margarita, we've got it loud and clear, and I appreciate your call. I mean, Charlene, I can imagine listeners here, lots of listeners in inland locations saying, well, thank heavens, we're not on the coast. Now, they've had their own weather problems, at least, maybe climate problems, tornado and so on. We saw what happened last year, just huge numbers. But do you see this coastal impact, quite apart from its impact on individual lives, but its fiscal impact hitting everybody, Charlene? Do you see it hitting inland Americans as well?
There's absolutely no question that everyone is going to feel these costs, whether it's through the tax dollars that get spent on post-disaster relief or on undercapitalized federal insurance programs for flooding, or if it's through our investments. You know, it's still amazing to me that very few large investors are even asking the question of how their assets in real estate, in infrastructure, and elsewhere might be exposed. Now, there are some examples of investors who are starting to ask those questions. One of them is Prudential Real Estate Advisors, part of the Prudential Life Insurance Company, which is looking at its real estate assets in the due diligence process before acquisition to see what sort of exposure they might have to sea level rise. Unfortunately, what they found is, you know, it's a fairly straightforward exercise if you're asking about assets in Europe. In the EU, countries are required to report on their climate vulnerability. That is not the case in the United States. And so the onus then is on the individual investor, the institutional investor, to start to assess what sort of exposure there might be over time and what impact that might have on the value of that asset. So it will touch every part of our economy.
Ben Strauss, is there a way and is there time to forestall some of the impacts that you're describing here? Could we take steps around fossil fuels, conservation, you name it, that would put this off, or is it already baked in the cake?
Well, we can slow it down, and we can reduce the total amount of sea level rise by cutting back swiftly and strongly on our heat-trapping pollution, on our fossil fuel emissions. But a lot already is baked in the cake. So at the same time, we need to work to prepare. And there are a lot of ways to do that that we need to start looking at across the country.
David Patton, when you sit around, I don't know, watching one of those beautiful sunsets over beer and thinking about the future, how do you think it's going to play out? You're there in Sarasota. This has been a big, vibrant coastal community for a long time. And yet there are new realities facing all of us here. How do you think this is going to play out, David? What's your guess?
I'm thinking down the road here, 20, 30 years, we could have water up in Siesta Village.
What does that mean for those of us who don't know the...
As it comes up, every time we get a high tide, like full moon on this island is so much different than it was 20 years ago because the full moon pulls the tide.
So when you say into Siesta Village, does that mean far inland? Is that what you're saying? Or sort of?
This is a 11-mile-long, 1-mile-wide island at the status point, and the pass at the far end of the island was Midnight Pass. A well-known artist named Sid Solomon used to have a house there. It washed away 10 years ago. The Gulf, they made him tear down what was left of it, and they would not let them rebuild. So I think it's going to affect all of us.
Do you think you just
all the barrier islands?
Will you get up on stilts? Will you try to build a dike? Will you leave?
Nope. I'll get off the island.
Wow.
Going to have to. I mean, what are you going to do?
It's a big, big trend line with different local implications all around the country. David Patton.
The tax base here is amazing. We feed most of the county, all the barrier islands, feed everything inland.
Yeah.
Our taxes pay for all the infrastructure on the mainland.
So just another piece of possible consequences if that tax base washes away. David Patton with Two Green Thumbs Landscaping. They count on having landscape to work on there. Long.
Everything I plant now is salt tolerant.
Yeah, good for you. Maybe a seascape coming up. David, thank you so much for joining us from Sarasota today.
For a reason.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, David. Charlene Lurig with Ceres in Austin, Texas, watching insurance and cost issues. It's great to have you from Austin today, Charlene. Thank you very much for your insights.
Thank you for having me.
And Ben Strauss at Climate Central, joining us today from New York, co-author of the big new report, Surging Seas. Ben, thank you for your work and sharing your time and thoughts with us today.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.